Okay then, brethren, moving on to a new topic. Today, we did a detailed review of the book of Daniel, the prophecy of Daniel, just under 2 years ago. That was our usual sort of Bible study type of study, meaning every chapter, every verse from beginning to end. But I've had a request to do a brief summary version of the prophecies of Daniel. To do a brief summary, which means ideally, I guess, packing it into maybe, you know, 2 weeks, perhaps three at a push, been hard to know ahead of time, but pretty brief, not going through every verse of every chapter, but just hitting, if you like, the high points, chapter by chapter. And then the request is, you know, can I do a chart at the end of it to hit the key points of each chapter? And I'll try and do that. But I suppose one question one might ask is, well, okay, but why choose the book of Daniel to review rather than, say, any of the other books of prophecy like Isaiah or Nahum or Amos or Zechariah? Why Daniel? What's so special about Daniel? Well, let's have a couple of scriptures just to show us why Daniel is a fairly important book here. Let's open our Bibles at Matthew 24. The Olivet Prophecy from the Lord Jesus, Matthew 24. And let's begin with verses 3 and 4. So you're very familiar with Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, the Olivet Prophecy. But verse 3 says, "Now as Jesus sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?'" And we've all got questions here. Yes, what is the sign of Jesus' return? How do we know he's about to come back? Well, in the answer, Jesus says, let's read verses 15 to 16. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place," and then in brackets, Matthew has added the words, "whoever reads this, let him understand." Understand what? Well, understand about what Daniel wrote about the abomination of desolation in the holy place, right? So Jesus says, make sure you understand what Daniel talked about. Matthew adds, make sure you understand what Daniel wrote about. Because Jesus says, when you see this abomination of desolation, then verse 16, "let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." And it's urgent. You don't stop. Why? Verses 21 and 22, "for then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved." So when the disciples ask about Jesus' return, he says, watch out for what Daniel the prophet has written about. Matthew says, make sure you understand Daniel's prophecy about this particular event, the abomination of desolation, because that will usher in a time of world trouble unlike any. It will dwarf the First World War, the Second World War, into being insignificant by comparison. So, pretty obviously, Daniel's prophecies are key critical to being alert to end-time dangers, right? Now let's look at Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13. Start with verses 1 and 2. You know, Revelation is, probably most of us agree, yet future. You know, it's the book of Revelation of the end times. Not everybody believes that, of course. There are a number of people who belong to a sort of Bible study, I guess, a group known as preterists, and they believe that everything's already been fulfilled. So Matthew 24, Revelation was all fulfilled way back in 70 AD or something. Those people, I believe, in preterism. But most of us, I guess, listening today at least, believe the book of Revelation is yet future, which certainly I believe, and let's look at verses 1 and 2 of chapter 13. So here's something to look out for in the end time. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns. And on his horns, 10 crowns, on his head, a blasphemous name. What could this be? A seven-headed beast with 10 horns. Verse 2, now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear. His mouth like the mouth of a lion. And it was the dragon who gave him his power, throne, and great authority, or the devil. Drop down to verse 7. And it was granted to him, this beast, to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. So here's a rather horrifying beast in the end times who makes war and overcomes the saints. Now, how are we supposed to understand this beast? Who is this beast? What does this beast represent? Well, the beast has 7 heads, 10 horns, and has similarities to a leopard, a bear, and a lion. I think we all understand, without necessarily being experts on it, that's the composite beast of Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel chapter 7, there are 4 beasts with 7 heads between them, 10 horns, one beast is like a lion, one beast is like a bear, one beast is like a leopard, and then there's a great and terrible beast with iron teeth. So I think most Bible scholars understand that this beast of Revelation 13 is a composite of the beast, beasts plural, of Daniel chapter 7. So therefore, if we want to understand the book of Revelation and its end time symbols, we really need to understand the book of Daniel, because that's where many of the symbols are drawn from. So therefore, with those two verses alone, or those two passages, I think we can see that the book of Daniel is pretty relevant for end time believers. Okay, so with that, let's make our start, and we'll start obviously in chapter 1 of the book of Daniel. So chapter 1 of Daniel, and let's read verses 1 through 6 as our introduction, beginning in verse 1. In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with some of the articles of the house of God, the temple, which Nebuchadnezzar carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. And then the king, Nebuchadnezzar, instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, so these were captives taken away to Babylon, young men in whom there was no blemish but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, these got to be bright characters, who had ability to serve in the king's palace and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies, King James might say meat, and of the wine which he drank, and also they get 3 years of training for them, a bit like a college course, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Going to be trained in Chaldean language, Chaldean literature, going to learn from scratch how to speak the language and understand the literature and how to write and so on. 3 years personal training, and then they go before the king to be his young servants. Verse 6, now from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, whom we know as shake the bed, make the bed, and into bed you go. That's the names they were given. So these four characters are sort of named here as being particularly recognized. They are bright young men, probably teenagers, in fact, probably young teenagers at this stage, and they're brought as captives to Babylon. And it turns out very early on that they have to face a little bit of a test, because they are to be given provision on a day-by-day basis, it says there in verse 5, of the king's delicacies. Now, I'm not quite sure what the king's delicacies includes. You know, it could be, you know, could be a nice sponge cake, you know, chocolate ice cream. But the odds are there's a lot of stuff in that that wouldn't be necessarily advisable. It almost certainly wouldn't be kosher, you know, clean, and probably not particularly healthful. But at the end of the day, it's the menu set apart by King Nebuchadnezzar. Do you want to really tell him you can take his menu and stick it? Tricky one, isn't it? So here's these young guys who are probably teenagers who decide that, you know what, we can't go down this route. We can't eat unclean meats and stuff that's probably come out of some really dodgy place. So they want to negotiate. So Daniel says to the chief of the eunuchs, tell you what, we'd rather not. We'd rather eat just simple stuff. And the eunuch says, well, can't do that. I mean, he liked Daniel. Daniel already had favor with him. But he says, it's my neck on the block. You know, if you eat your stuff and you end up being all miserable and losing weight and pale-faced, and the king finds out what I've done, he'll have my head. And Daniel says, no, don't worry about it. You just give us vegetables, nice drinks of water, and you test us just for 10 days. That's all we're asking, just 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, you decide whether we look healthier than the rest or worse than the rest, and then we'll go with your judgment. And the eunuch says, oh, fair enough, 10 days, I can certainly do that. And of course, 10 days pass, and lo and behold, Daniel and his three colleagues are in the pink of condition. Nice and healthy, strong, clear-headed. And so he allows them to continue. And 3 years later, they're ready to go before the king. So let's pick up the story in verses 17 through 21. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days, that's when the 3 years college course, if you like, had concluded, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and then the king interviewed them. And among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and therefore they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding by which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. So these four young men, you know, really stood out. If they were teenagers when they went to Babylon, only 3 years have elapsed now. They might be, 20, 19, not sure really. But young guys. And if you look at them already, they've already demonstrated a certain amount of courage and faithfulness to God in a hostile environment. Right? They were taken to Babylon as slaves. They're in the king's courts. They're expected to eat off the king's personally chosen menu with all the dodgy stuff in it. And they could have gone along and compromised, but these young men said, no, we want to be faithful to our God, faithful to his ways, faithful to his laws. And even though that potentially could have cost them their lives, for all we know, they stood their ground. And they were wise. They negotiated a test They passed the test, so they weren't just, you know, rude and abrupt, but nonetheless, they stood their ground. They remained faithful to God in a very difficult environment. And when I was just reading that early in the week, I was thinking by comparison about Lot. I had meant to do a message comparing Noah and Lot, because Jesus uses both Noah and Lot as examples of what's to come in the end times. You know, or as it was in the days of Noah. So will it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. So Noah and Lot, there's a number of similarities, but also some important differences. But thinking of Lot, you know, Lot at one point lived along with Abraham, had thousands of, had thousands of animals, flocks, herds, extremely wealthy. There were so many of his animals that they sort of bumped into Abraham's flocks and herds. So at one point, Lot chose to move away onto what he saw as better territory. Yet he ended up living in Sodom. Now, why would you choose to go and live in a wicked city, a well-known wicked city like Sodom? And he, in my view, was a compromiser. So why is he in the first place? He compromised his standards by living involuntarily in and among wicked people. You remember he was delivered, but he's only given very, very little warning. Just a matter of an hour to get out of his house, out of the city. He had no personal authority with his sons-in-law, his married daughters. He tried to warn them and they just thought he was just a mocker, scoffing. He had no authority with them because I think he was known to be a compromiser. And Lot left Sodom and lost everything. His thousands of animals, his camels, herds, flocks, lost everything. His home, his married daughters, sons-in-law, even lost his wife. Remember Lot's wife. The man was a compromiser and paid a severe penalty for that. He escaped, but by the skin of his teeth. Not a good outcome, unlike, say, Noah. Much better outcome. But comparing here, you know, Daniel as a very young man, faithful under pressure. And so I would summarize chapter 1 as Daniel and his friends remain faithful to their God. That's chapter 1. Okay, let's move on to chapter 2, and let's start with verses 1 through 6. Now, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. So he sat up, bolt upright in bed. Oh, my word, that was horrifying. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans, you know, the really expert gurus of the day, to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said to them, "Well, I have had a dream of dreams, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream, what it meant." And the Chaldean spoke to the king in Aramaic. I'll come back in a moment to highlight this word Aramaic. The Chaldean spoke to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation." But it does seem that Nebuchadnezzar is a little bit suspicious of his religion, I think, and his priests and wise men. And he says to the Chaldeans, "My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces and your houses shall be made in an ash heap, burned in fire. However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you'll receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation." Now, of course, that's a bit embarrassing for the astrologers and the magicians and wise men, because they've got no clue, right? And so Nebuchadnezzar is irate, decides he's going to do away with all the wise men, gives instructions, okay, chop all the heads off. And then that process starts. Daniel finds out. Daniel prays to God for understanding. And Daniel receives that understanding and is brought before King Nebuchadnezzar. And what becomes very evident here is that God is dealing with King Nebuchadnezzar in a very special way. I'm not sure if you spotted that before. It's not something I've highlighted before, but it becomes very evident that God chose Nebuchadnezzar and dealt with him on a very personal way that brought Nebuchadnezzar to a very special place ultimately. We'll see that more as we continue. But before we go any further, Daniel 2 verse 4 says the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. What's not clear in the English translation is that from that verse 4, from chapter 2 verse 4, until the end of chapter 7, it's all written in Aramaic. Now, the Bible, of course, the Old Testament is Hebrew. New Testament was written in Greek. But from verse 4 here until the end of chapter 7 is all written in Aramaic. And why is that? Well, the reason appears to be that Aramaic was the language of most of the countries across the known world of those days, not obviously China and Japan, but, you know, the Middle East countries, the ones that surround Israel and so on, all those countries spoke Aramaic. It was the first language or second language of everybody, pretty much. And what it turns out is the content that you and I are going to read, probably today, chapters 2 and 3 and 4, 5, 6 and 7, all of that was written in the Aramaic language and was published for the whole world of that time to read. So the whole Gentile world of Aramaic-speaking people found out from the highest level about the great God of Israel. That was quite special. Up until that time, you know, God dealt with people like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, you know, Moses, the house of Israel, the house of Judah. But God had not dealt in any special way with the Gentile nations of the world. But here, this whole section of the Bible is written in Aramaic, the language of the people of that day. And we'll see how that develops. So anyway, God gives Daniel understanding of the dream, and Daniel turns up to explain to King Nebuchadnezzar. Look at verse 28. Daniel says, "There is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these." So it's about times to come. Let's drop down to verses 31 to 36. "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image, a great statue. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron, partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. And then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away, so that no trace of them was found. They completely vanished. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain that filled the whole earth. This is the dream." And of course, you can only imagine that King Nebuchadnezzar's, you know, eyes are in stalks at this point. Oh, this young man, and I think he's still barely 20-odd, has just told me what I dreamed. How incredible. This man's God must be a really special God. So I guess the seeds are now sown that there is a God in heaven who can reveal great secrets, because this young Jewish boy has just told me what I dreamed, which my own religious priests and wise men couldn't do. What does that tell me about my religion and my priests and my wise men? Interesting, I must come back to that. Anyway, moving on, Daniel says, "Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven Well, this is interesting. The God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand, and he has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. And I suspect, by saying that Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold, then we're talking here about Nebuchadnezzar being perhaps the greatest of all the Gentile leaders. He's the top of the totem pole. He's the head of gold. He's the man that God singled out. But after you, verse 39, shall arise another king, another kingdom, sorry, inferior to yours. Then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth within the remit of the prophecy. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces, shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. And we'll come back to that. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay, partly iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron, partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong, partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, pictured by the feet and probably the toes, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And that kingdom, God's kingdom, shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it broke in pieces, the iron, bronze, clay, silver, gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain. The interpretation is sure. And, of course, Nebuchadnezzar is quite rightly stunned. Falls on his face, wants to worship Daniel. Can't believe what he's heard. All right? It's an amazing, I guess, illumination to Nebuchadnezzar that there's a God in heaven who can work through this young man and tell him what is going to happen in the future. Now, okay, how do we interpret the four metals? Well, gold, we're told quite bluntly there, gold is Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom. So gold represents the Babylonian Empire. Today, we call Babylon Iraq. That becomes relevant when we get to chapter 7. Iraq appears in prophecy. The silver is the Persian Empire. I think we probably mostly know that. And today we call Persia Iran. And of course the Iranian Empire becomes relevant in our day today. The third one, bronze, would be what is typically called the Greek Empire. I think Greek can be a bit misleading because Greek we might just think of the small country of Greece. This was really a realm that spread from Greece eastward right across to India. So the whole Middle East, southern Russia, Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, North Africa, Egypt, that was really, I think most people probably call it the Hellenistic realm, the Hellenistic Empire, not just, you know, Greece. And then we've got the Iron Empire, which I'm going to suggest is the Islamic Empire from the 600s AD all the way through to 1922-ish. And then the stone is, of course, Jesus Christ at his return establishing the kingdom of God. So Babylon, Iraq, Persia, Iran, Greek / Turkey / Hellenistic, then the Islamic Empire of iron leading up to Jesus' return. Which, of course, gives us a bit of a problem because, you know, most people say the Iron Empire is the Roman Empire or the Holy Roman Empire or some combination of such. So why is it not? Why do I suggest that the Iron is not the Roman Empire? Well, look at verse 40. The fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all these things, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Right? So the Bible tells us this iron kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others that came before it. The word break in pieces in Aramaic is a dekak, D-E-Q-A-Q in our language, dekak. And it means pretty much what it says, break in pieces, but other translations are shatter, smash, pulverize, and Brenton's Septuagint translation translates it as beat to powder. You think of a sledgehammer and get out there and you've got some concrete and it's breaking up and you just bash it and bash it and bash it until it breaks into fragments. You keep bashing it until there's just powder that's left. That's what it means to break in pieces. And the Iron Empire will break in pieces all the others. That's what the Bible tells us. So all we've got to do is find, well, first of all, did Rome break in pieces and pulverize and smash all the others? That's a piece of cake to find out. Just check the history books. Rome never conquered Babylon. Oops. Rome never conquered Persia. Oops. Rome never pulverized Greece. So that's strike three, I think. Now, Rome's armies met up with the Greek armies and defeated the Greek armies. But in terms of Greek culture, Greek architecture, the Greek religion, and the Greek language, and Greek literature, all that remained. It wasn't smashed and pulverized into powder. The Romans actually were quite attracted to Greek culture and architecture and copied lots of it. They left the religion, just borrowed some of the gods. And in fact, even at the time of Jesus and the apostles, hundreds of years later, Greek was still the normal language that most people spoke. The Bible was written in Greek, the New Testament. So Rome fails the biblical test. Islam, on the other hand, fits. Because as the Islamic Empire moved out of Arabia, it destroyed and smashed to pieces everything it came across. Just think of ISIS, 3 or 4 years ago, what it does. The Islamic Empire, as it spread, it destroyed all other religions. It destroyed culture. It burned down and sacked libraries. It changed languages. It even altered people's alphabets to become Arabic alphabets. So yeah, Islam destroyed everything. And some people have calculated that Islam in its 1400 years has killed something like 270 million people in jihad. 270 million over 1400 years. And the world wasn't as big, 100 years ago and so on as it is today. Today we've got maybe 7 billion people. You go back a few hundred years, you're talking about, 400 or 500 million people. So, in chapter 2, I think we can say that the summary would be that God reveals to Nebuchadnezzar the four empires that dominate until Jesus returns. God reveals to Nebuchadnezzar the four empires that will dominate until Jesus returns. Now, at this point, Nebuchadnezzar has probably sort of seen through the falsity of the Babylonian religion, its priests. He's acknowledged that Daniel's God is a pretty special God. He can reveal, things to come, but Nebuchadnezzar's not going to change yet. So in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar erects a great image. And he requires that everybody is going to worship his special image. Now, as you'd expect, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego obviously, they've already proven they will be faithful in chapter 1, so they refuse.
Sorry, chapter 2.
And they will be faithful to God, even if they have to face down martyrdom. Right? We're not going to worship your image, Nebuchadnezzar. Whether you kill us or not, we're not going to do it. We're going to be faithful to our God in heaven. Which is quite a good testimony to Nebuchadnezzar. But what about you and me? You know, some believers are going to face the Antichrist and the end-time beast empire. They're going to be threatened with beheading if they don't accept the mark of the beast. Would you be as faithful in those days as Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego? Anyway, let's turn to chapter 3 and pick up the story in verses 18 through 30. Chapter 3, verses 18 through 30. So here they are talking to King Nebuchadnezzar. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury. He tried to give him a way out. And the expression on his face changed towards Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning, fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments and were cast into the midst of the burning, fiery furnace. And therefore, because the king's command was urgent or harsh and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning, fiery furnace. That's them gone, isn't it? Toast. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the midst of the fire?" The answer said to the king, "True, O king, whatever you say, O king." "Look," he answered, "I see 4 men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the form of the 4th is like," it probably means like, "a son of the gods." Then King Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke. Didn't get too near, of course. He's already got some toasted soldiers nearby. And he shouts, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. And the satraps, administrators, governors, king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were any of their garments affected. Even the smell of fire was not on them. This is really quite astonishing. And Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own god." So Nebuchadnezzar had a great dream of the future in chapter 2. Now in chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar sees these 3 wise men delivered by a miracle from a fiery furnace. And he's astonished. He's taken aback. This is unheard of. What type of God is it that Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego serve? So he's sort of stunned. And verse 29, "Therefore," says Nebuchadnezzar, the rather ruthless king of the whole world in those days, "I make a decree that any people, any nation, any language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there's no other God who can deliver like this." And then, of course, the 3 young men are promoted. So here's the king of the whole empire and he issues a decree in Aramaic, recounting, one imagines, the story, which is written down at some later stage in Aramaic, so the whole world can read the details. And Nebuchadnezzar, as emperor, issues a decree saying, nobody anywhere in my vast realm better say anything against the God of these Jewish boys. Now, that's got to be a sort of message that people start to wonder about. So the summary of chapter 3 is God reveals his power to Nebuchadnezzar as he delivers the faithful Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the fiery pit. God reveals his power, even more if you like, to Nebuchadnezzar as he delivers his faithful saints from a fiery pit. And you can maybe even see here a hint about perhaps some saints being delivered from the fires of the Great Tribulation, or even the deliverance of saints from the fires of hell. There's obviously levels at which we can understand that. But Nebuchadnezzar clearly knows a lot more about the Most High God than he once did. And in a sense, he's even been preaching here, hasn't he, to the known world. He's issued a decree saying, nobody, anywhere, say anything against this God of heaven. But of course, he himself is not changing. He's still proud, he's still arrogant. But it seems that God is not finished with Nebuchadnezzar. God's about to intervene in a major way by condemning Nebuchadnezzar to 7 years of madness. And Daniel 4 gives us Nebuchadnezzar's personal testimony written by himself to the whole world in Aramaic so that everybody can understand it, saying that there is no God like Jehovah. So in Daniel 4, Nebuchadnezzar has yet another dream, a frightening dream, terrifying dream, where he sees a great tree cut down with only the stump remaining. As usual, he calls for his astrologers and Chaldeans who are unable to explain or unwilling to explain until Daniel comes along. So let's pick up the story in Daniel chapter 4. When Daniel turns up on the scene in verses 19 through 26, then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him when he heard about the dream. So the king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream concern those who hate you, and its interpretation concern your enemies. You know, Daniel's quite concerned. He knows what it means. And, you know, he's got some respect for Nebuchadnezzar. The tree that you saw, which grew and became strong, whose height reached to the heavens, which could be seen by all the earth, whose leaves were lovely and its fruit abundant, in which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and on whose branches the birds of the heaven had their habitation. It is you, O king, who have grown and become strong, for your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, your dominion to the end of the earth. I think Nebuchadnezzar is something special. Not sure what the history books would tell us, but it just does look like he's a really outstanding, ruthless and arrogant. But he's obviously got a lot going for him in some ways. And inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field. Let it be wet with the dew of heaven. Let him graze with the beasts of the field till 7 times pass over him. 7 times being probably 7 years. This is interpretation, O king. And this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. They shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They will make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and 7 times, maybe 7 years, shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and gives it to whomever he chooses. And inasmuch as they gave the command to leave their stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you, after you come to know that heaven rules. This is not good news, of course, to King Nebuchadnezzar. And you think, oh, right, straight away he's going to repent and sackcloth and ashes. Nope. Daniel tells him, my lord, please instantly repent. Get right with God. Live right. But nope. God gave him plenty of time because 12 months elapses, 12 months a year. And then one day, while Nebuchadnezzar's wandering around his royal palace and boasting about how great he is, the clock stops ticking. Verse 33. That very hour, the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers. You know, long, stiff, unkempt. His nails like birds' claws, like talons. So the great, mighty, glorious, majestic King Nebuchadnezzar is out in the fields, in the bushes, in the wilderness, living like a wild animal, apparently for 7 years. Whew. Verse 34 and 35. At the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? So it looks like Nebuchadnezzar has now completely learned his lesson. You certainly get the impression he's now praising God, honoring God, worshipping God. In a sense, why wouldn't he? And now notice verses 36 through 7. At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, this is a letter that Nebuchadnezzar wrote in Aramaic to the whole world. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, king and emperor of the whole world, praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice, and all those who walk in pride, let me assure you, he is able to abase. Right? Now look at Daniel 4 verses 1 through 3. This is how the chapter begins. Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It's almost like the Apostle Paul. Grace and peace to you. So Nebuchadnezzar, the head of gold, the mighty, arrogant man who ruled the empire ruthlessly, is writing to everybody across, you know, thousands and thousands of square miles, provinces, states, territories, regions. I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. How great are his signs! How mighty his wonders! His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. Then he gives his story. So finally, Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges the true God. And we could speculate, got a sneaky feeling, that he may even have fully turned to God. I think he's certainly in a better place than, say, King Solomon, who started so well but ended up trying to kill, you know, God's prophets. I think King Nebuchadnezzar looks like in a better place than many other kings of Israel and Judah. And I'm not going to turn there, but you'll find quite a number of places where God calls Nebuchadnezzar, my servant Nebuchadnezzar. My servant Nebuchadnezzar. Interesting. And so I'd summarize chapter 4 as Nebuchadnezzar humbled for 7 years and comes to God. Chapter 5 brings the story of another king of Babylon. But unlike Nebuchadnezzar, this king rejects God and loses everything. So approximately 23 years passes from the story of Nebuchadnezzar there. We now have a man called Belshazzar on the throne of Babylon, He's its last king. And we pick up the story of a great feast in Daniel 5, verses 1 through 4. Belshazzar, the king, still of Babylon, made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. That's a big party, isn't it? Got 1,000 nobles there. It's going to be a pretty big palace, big room. There'll be a lot of wine as well to have 1,000 people drunk. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, his concubines might drink from them. Maybe a little bit provocative? Bring the gold utensils from the temple of Jehovah? We want to drink and make merry? Verse 3. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. Okay. Fair enough, Ski. But then somebody spoils the party.
Because a
hand, just a hand, and I suppose maybe a forearm, appears, really, and writes a mysterious message on the wall. And poor old Belshazzar is terrified. It says his knees knock and he's in a bad way. Of course, calls for all the astrologers, wise men, Chaldeans, who are unable to help. And eventually, you know, Daniel gets called. Let's pick up the story of Daniel's explanation, verses 18 through 31. Daniel 5, verse 18. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty, glory, honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, languages trembled and feared before him. Like I say, Nebuchadnezzar, I think, was probably a very outstanding individual. Whomever he wished, he executed, obviously ruthless with it. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. Whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, even though God had tried through the dream with Daniel and through the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego incident, he was very slow to respond until, you know, God drove him out for 7 years into the wilderness. But when his heart was lifted up, verse 20, and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts. His dwelling was with wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew or recognized that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. See, here's one of the problems. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar wrote everything down. He issued decrees to the whole world. He wrote his own personal testimony of coming to God. Daniel 4 is in Aramaic, as is Daniel 2, 3, 4, spread around the entire world. Belshazzar knew the story of his father, or might have been grandfather. It's all there, it's in writing, right? And yet, what does Belshazzar do? Ignores it, rejects it, and in fact, having a party now with items from God's temple. Verse 23, and you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and knows all your ways, you have not glorified. So then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this writing was written. And this is the inscription that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom, Belshazzar, and finished it. Oops, not such good news. Tickle, you've been weighed in the balance, and you're a lightweight. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. And then Belshazzar did what he promised to do. He gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be third ruler in the kingdom. And that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. Right? And that, in fact, was the end of the Babylonian Empire. The next verse says, Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old, Mede, you know, Persians and Medes. So that's the end of the Babylonian Empire. Belshazzar was its final king. So in Daniel chapter 4 and Daniel chapter 5, you've actually got two chapters which rather echo each other. We'll see more of that next week. But you've got two kings, right? One turned to God, eventually, Nebuchadnezzar, and one, of course, rejected God and lost his life and indeed lost the entire kingdom at that point. So the summary, I would say, of chapter 5 is that Belshazzar rejects the lessons of God. And the writing on the wall announces his death and the end of the Babylonian Empire. And then chapter 6 brings us to the story of Daniel in the lion's den, which I can see I'm not going to have a chance to complete. That's a pity. I thought I'd get a bit further than that today. Other than to say just today that we'll get to Daniel in the lion's den, but Daniel chapter 6 is Daniel in the lion's den. Daniel chapter 3 is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery pit. Those two chapters do also echo each other. I'll cover that again next week. But in chapter 3, you've got a king throwing saints into a fiery pit. In chapter 6, you've got a king throwing a saint into a lion's pit. In chapter 3, God delivers the saints from the fiery pit. In chapter 6, God delivers the saint from the lion's pit. Lots of correlations there. But we'll have to wait and do that next week. So today we'll conclude there and hopefully get a bit further in 1 week's time. And that will conclude today's Bible study.